So, okay. Okay. So we are talking about the self, and I hope it wasn't too confusing that in the orientation I got the chapter numbers wrong. I was still working off my initial confusion about why I hadn't assigned chapter 21, which I certainly should have. It's a very important chapter, and it's the one that we're going to focus on today. So, you know, we've been looking at time, and we've been looking at the self, and I want to make clear the relationship between the two. I mean, the chapter really makes clear the relationship between the two. And we've talked about it in various ways. But here, I want to focus on what seems to me the central issue, and it's actually stated very clearly on page 173 in that italicized sentence right at the in the middle of the page, where Rinpoche writes, "The ongoing persistence of a unified self." And it's important to remember that that unified self is us. It's not like we're doing some anthropological survey into why people have this idea of a self. You know, we ourselves are completely convinced about being who we are. Maybe sometimes it's a little bit less certain than other times, or maybe sometimes there seem to be some openings. But generally, we're just completely convinced that you know, we are who we are. And that's the self we're talking about, nobody else's self. So the ongoing persistence of a unified self appears to the mind as a self-evident truth. And I want to stop there for a moment, because one of the things that I've been thinking about a lot in this program, you know, in our classes so far, starting in January, I guess, is why there is a difficulty, you could say, in engaging this material. I think that now that we're really focusing more on the self, it's loosening up, and I think it's easier for people. I'm basing this partly on some feedback I've gotten, but partly just my own sense in reviewing, going over the material myself. I think there's been a loosening up, but there is a kind of a difficulty. And, you know, for me, this is really important. It's not maybe so important for those of you who are taking the program, but I have this question that's always active for me whenever I'm working with TSK, which is, how can we make the connection? How can I make the connection? How can people make the connection to the books, to the vision? Because the history of TSK, as I think you all know, is that people who get involved with it find it very engaging and very liberating, you know, at least at times when you feel you're in tune with it. And that sense of liberation, I think, is really one of the key elements in TSK. But not a lot of people just don't make the connection. A lot of people find it, you know, what people say is it's too intellectual, it's too heady, things like that. And there may be something to that, because it's a very careful presentation. It's you've really got to think about it a lot. Or it's not so much that you've got to think about it. You have to really be willing to trace out what's being said and take it back into your own experience. And that involves a certain kind of skill that people sometimes in their education are frightened away from. And so, you know, that kind of fear comes back to haunt them when they start TSK and they say, oh, I can't do this. But, you know, maybe we're at a good moment to talk about that fear, because you say, oh, well, that's an interesting story. You know, that's That's an interesting approach you have to your own life. What makes you confident that that particular version of the way things are is accurate? Is that those limitations that you're committed to really have to be the way they are? So that's one of the questions that I keep asking myself. But one of the answers that I give about why it's difficult to engage this material, apart from what I was just saying, is that TSK is really rigorous about not making concessions to the self, not trying to put things in terms that are comfortable for the self. And one of the ways that it does that is by always referring back to the self and the structures of the self. But another way that it does it, and the way that is probably more fundamental, is it's always looking at these really underlying structures of time and space and the kind of knowledge that time and space offer. And in particular, when you're talking about the self, you're talking about time. So this is all, I guess, a commentary on this first sentence that I started to read on page 173. The ongoing persistence of the unified self appears to the mind as a self-evident truth. It does. It you know, we are completely convinced by that, and at the same time, we're completely convinced, and these two things, it's not just that we're convinced about point one and we're convinced about point two. We're convinced about one reality, or in the terms introduced in this chapter, we're convinced about one story. And that story goes off in two directions, multiple directions, but there's two that we're focusing on. One is this existence of a unified self, this persistence of a unified self. And the other is the nature of time, which supports that unified self. And both of those just seem beyond question, you know, self-evident. So that's what we're looking at, and this chapter is really important, I think, in giving us a kind of a turning point, you could say, you know, there's a famous image and quote in Western thought, Archimedes, who was the a Greek scientist and thinker, and is credited with being the inventor of a lever. The lever, you know, I remember from like eighth grade physics that there's five basic tools, right? There's the wedge and the lever and, I don't know, stairs, I think, or slopes or something. Anyway, there's a bunch of them. One of them's the lever. And Archimedes is said to have said, give me a lever long enough and a place to stand, and I could move the world. Which is a very interesting image. The part of it that's really interesting is, where is that place to stand? You know, it's a very hypothetical construct, because you're always in the world. And that's exactly the nature of the problem that we have when we're trying to really let TSK guide us into something different. There's no place to stand. We are committed to the world that we've set up. We're committed to the story that we tell and the story that we're inhabited. And in particular, we're committed to the ongoing persistence of a unified self, as it says here. And you know, it's hard to know how to deal with that. It's hard to know how to question it. So one of the ways that TSK really tries to do that is by questioning time, because that's the one that's most related to the self, although, well, that's the one that's most obviously related to the self. And so there are exercises that work with time that I think are very difficult for people, and there are approaches to understanding time that are very difficult for people. people. And in a sense, they should be difficult because of this issue that we don't have a place to stand. You know, we can't say, well, let me just drop my ordinary understanding for a while. Let me just bracket that and not commit to it and try a different approach, because we are committed to it. We can't just say, let's do a thought experiment. You know, let's just pretend the time is not what it's like, and do it differently. You can't do that. You have to give some, you have to give some real effort. And part of that effort is the thinking through of what Rinpoche is saying in the TSK vision. It's not just the effort of setting aside what we ordinarily accept as true. It's the effort of letting the mind engage in new ways of thinking and envisioning. And the exercises are important in that, and the readings are important in that. So, still on this paragraph that's mostly in italics, we have this unified self, which seems to be self-evident and therefore is very difficult to go beyond. And then Rinpoche writes, it brings with it, this self-evident truth, brings with it two corollaries. The flow of experience from past to future and the objective existence of a surrounding world that is subject to that flow. So there's time, which unfolds in this linear way from past to present and future. And there's an objective world. We're born into a world which is subject to time. And again, those things are just really self-evident and therefore difficult to question. And the example of that that has always fascinated me, and I don't have anything particularly intelligent to say about it, but I'll bring it up because I think it's such an interesting question that it's one that you know, you can entertain all the time, is how calendar time works, or clock time. But I notice it especially with calendar time. So, you know, this Sunday we're having a class. Today, right now, we're having a session. Next Sunday, we're going to have another session. And I just know that next Sunday is going to roll around. You know, there's going to be a day and a night and a day and a night and a day and a night and so on, and then eventually it's going to be Sunday. And that's self-evident. There's no other possibility. Now you could get a little bit sophisticated and say, well, you know, subjectively, time may change during that period. And that's true, but it doesn't change the calendar time issue. And it's always just really intrigued me, you know, and in a way, the farther away the date is, the more interesting it is to me. You know, it's not if you go out 10 years, but you know, in April, for instance, I'm going to be traveling in Europe. And that's about a month away. And it's just going to be that way. You know? And day by day, I can see that time drawing nearer, drawing closer. And you know, I don't know if I can communicate what it is about that seems to me so interesting. It's self-evident, and yet I don't really understand it.
You can say it if you want. That's my plan for dinner.
Is that, okay, somebody's talking about something, but not about this program. Okay. That was not a question. So anyway, that is the reality that we find ourselves working with. Now, I want to call your attention, or in that context, I want to talk about exercise 22. That was the one that I suggested you might try to work on during the week. And exercise 22 is a pretty amazing exercise, really, because it asks us to do something that just completely undermines these points that we were just looking at. This, you the ongoing flow of linear time, right? It says, okay, so there's linear time and there's moments of time, and we go from one moment to the next moment, but somehow there has to be a transition between that moment, you know, one moment and the next moment, and that transition can't be just another moment, because then we'd have to look for the transition between that moment and the one before and the one after. So there has to be something else going on, temporally speaking, talking about time. And then it says, okay, so what do you see when you look for that? So did anybody work with that and have anything they want to say about it? Let me divide that up into two questions. Did anybody work with that?
Yes.
Okay, but you don't have anything you want to say about it, huh? Is there anything, you want to say anything about not saying, having anything to say about it?
Well, I can say, Michael, I was listening to a clock, sort of a tick-tock for two different sounds.
Mm-hmm.
There'd be no space between it. And I had a hard time keeping track of the tick and the clock. But the great difficulty of that maybe gave me a sense that there was a strata underneath.
Mm-hmm.
And these were like, so it was like too detailed and too fast for me to even attend to the surface. And that's maybe all I say.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay, and Lois is asking a question in the chat area about whether that X, that's what it's called in exercise 22, is that X transitional moment related to the bardo? Well, okay, so the bardo is a Buddhist concept. Tibetan Buddhist in particular emphasizes it. And the answer in a way is yes. I should say, whenever someone brings up a Buddhist topic, I should say, look, TSK is not Buddhist. But it may be that the idea of the bardo, it is the case that the idea of the bardo seems to me to be something like this, because the word bardo really just means between. No, not a very complicated word. And what it suggests is that between any two experiences, there's something. So between one moment and the next, there's something, and that's what we're looking at. Between one life and the next, there's something. We're not looking at that. There's actually six different examples that are given. I don't remember right now. So yes, you could say that there is something like that being pointed at in the bardo. And Lois is saying so. She just has a sense, an intuition that those two are connected. And maybe they are. Anybody else want to say anything about this experience of trying to investigate X? What is, Rinpoche asked the questions, what is the nature of X? How does it function?
Yeah, hello.
Yeah, Arthur.
Yeah, this is Arthur. I did a note on the paper about this question, what is the nature of X?
Mm-hmm.
My note is perhaps a kind of field.
Mm-hmm.
Because from one point to the next point, A to A1, I discovered a huge number of next X. So mm-hmm. I couldn't focus only point to point.
Mm-hmm.
Much. To see, so I did the note. Perhaps a kind of field.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Perhaps a kind of field. Well, that's interesting. You know, I'm not. My own experience is that it's very difficult. Not exactly. You know, it's not that it's difficult because we have to make some special kind of effort to notice the moment between, or I should say, the transition between moments. It's difficult because we don't even know how to start. All we have is moments.
How to what?
Can you repeat that question?
Certainly. You said we don't even know how to...
We don't even know how to look. We don't even know how to begin. We don't even know what the what is the arena for inquiry. You know, it's like I don't know if you were it's as though you didn't know that there was such a thing as air in the atmosphere. You know, and somebody said, "What's going on? What's going on between that rock and that tree? Is there anything available there to look at?" And you say, "No, it's just empty. There's nothing there. You know, there's the rock and the tree, and in between there's nothing at all." Now, in fact, we know, because we're so sophisticated scientifically, and actually everybody knew thousands of years ago, there is something in between the rock and the tree. There's air. But if you didn't know that, you wouldn't even know where to look. You wouldn't know how to ask the question. So, yeah, take a look at the comments that Lois is making in the chat room, those of you who are online, that maybe there's something kind of shimmering or there is, you know, it's something that's not familiar. That's true. And Arthur, you're asking about direct and indirect. I'm not quite sure what you have in mind there. You want to say more about that?
Yes, I cannot discriminate my investigating or my experience direct or indirect. I come to this point. I don't know.
Okay.
Perhaps I do it, but I cannot explain this discriminated work.
Okay.
Then?
Okay. I'm going to let that lie, but it's not something that's available to us, that transition between moments, because it lies in some other dimension. Now, I'm going to suggest that nonetheless, you give a little time, you take some time during the week to work with exercise 22. And you could take it into exercise 23 also, which builds on exercise 22. So that's the exercise at the end of the chapter that we will be reading for next week. It's all right not to know. And the reason we don't know is because we are so committed to the self. That's really the point that I'm making, you know, the fundamental point, let's say. We don't know how to do it because it doesn't make sense to us. Just because it doesn't make sense to us doesn't mean that it's not, that it couldn't be available. If we could recast, reformulate, rethink, reimagine, perhaps a better word, reimagine our experience. But the thing that is, you know, is really interesting about it, and now I'm going to go into the more into what the reading is about. The thing that is really interesting about it is that it's not a question of changing the story. What Rinpoche talks about here, and you know, he lays out these different forms of the self, which is very interesting, and we don't have time today, anyway, to go into that too much, but then he focuses on one aspect of the self, which is the self as narrator. And so the narrator is always telling these stories, and I want to say something about telling stories in a moment, but the narrator is always telling these stories. And you might say, okay, you know, right now the narrator is telling one story, and in the next moment of telling another story. So let me try telling a story in which somehow I have access to that transition point. And you know, that's a really radically different story. Somehow it has to be a story in which the self is not operating, maybe. But let me see if I can tell that story. Well, that's not going to work, because the whole notion of stories, the whole notion of telling or inhabiting a story, is exactly the same as the notion of linear temporality. You know, in this moment, there is a story available about what's happening. And in the next moment, there's another story available about what's happening. If we wanted somehow to go to that space, that you might say no self space, as Lois is suggesting I see here in the chats, or somebody else, I have to skim back up here, talked about a presence, sense of presence in. Who was that? Okay, Bruce. Good. If we wanted to go to that, we would somehow have to let go of the whole notion of story. And that's a big deal to do that. So let me say something about stories, and I mentioned this in the orientation, but I want to say something more about it because this is actually something that I've kind of thought through and worked out for myself, and it's a little different, it fills in something that Rinpoche doesn't address. Let me put it that way. Rinpoche, when he talks about stories, talks about it in terms of a narrator, and he often speaks of telling a story. But I think it's actually helpful to make this distinction between the stories that we tell and the stories that we live. The stories that we tell, one typical kind of story is an explanation. You know, we just say, well, this is how it happened. This is how it came to be. And sometimes stories are theories. Right? We say, well, it must have been that I wasn't paying enough attention or something like that. That's basically a theory. In the case of what we're talking about now, and Rinpoche is very clear about this, you could say this whole discussion, this whole way of looking at the self as the narrator or the other alternative, the self as the owner, the self as the interpreter, the objective self, and so on, that's really all just a told story too, a narrative. And, you know, a way of making sense. Stories are about making sense out of our experience. But there's also the lived story. And I think that it's helpful to really make that distinction because it's only when we realize that we're always living a story, that we're always in the middle of a story. Whether we're saying something to ourselves or explaining something to ourselves or not, that we begin to see how pervasive the story is. And Lois asked the question, I think this is exactly right, I'm looking at the chat again, can't you tell a story in a different way that is an invitation, she asks, into this other way of thinking? Yes, you can. And, you know, why does Rinpoche bother to write Love of Knowledge, you know? It's because he's got a story to tell. And what's the purpose of telling that story? It's to invite a different way of being. You know, it's a story that is, you could say, meant to put an end to stories. That's not quite right because we don't, it's all right for stories to keep going, but it's a story that's meant to lead us into a way of being that doesn't depend on stories, you could put it that way. So the point that the reason it seems to me valuable to talk about lived stories is that when you're looking that way, you have the opportunity to realize that you are always inhabiting a story. So I actually gave an example at the very beginning of the phone call this morning, which is one that, you know, may apply to some of you and not to others, but sometimes we are telling a story about our involvement with TSK, and maybe we say, it's too hard, it's too complicated. Right? So that may be a story that we tell ourselves. We pick up the book and, you know, or you read something, let's say you read a paragraph and you don't understand it, and there's this little story that gets told You know, and you tell it to yourself. You tell it very quickly, and in fact, if it's a story that you're used to, you know, a story that is somehow part of your self-image, then it takes almost no time at all to tell it, because you're just so used to it. It's like pressing the right button, you know, like when a radio announcer presses the button that runs an advertisement or something. You just press the button, it goes by really quickly. But you tell yourself that story. This is hard, I can't do this, this is, I don't understand, I never understand things like this, you know, there's some past experience that kind of very quickly goes by in your mind. All of that may be a story that you tell yourself. But when you tell yourself that story, really what you're doing is reinforcing a story that is more the story of who you are and how you relate to certain kinds of experience. It's the reality of your situation. And that is the lived story. And I think that it's helpful to look at that, but I think that the way that we want, the way we can find out for ourselves whether it's helpful is to try. And what I'm going to suggest, therefore, as well as an exercise that you can be doing more during the week, is exercise 21, the one that's at the end of this chapter, which is about, I think it's called protecting and projecting. And it invites us to look at the stories, and I think here it says the stories that we tell. Well, it doesn't actually say, it uses the word narrative. And then it asks us to explore deeper narratives. Right? The idea of, you know, ordinary narratives and deeper narratives, maybe that's something like told stories and lived stories. But I do encourage you and invite you to look at that. And that's actually easier to do than this other exercise because we're very used to the idea of psychology in this culture. You know, we're in the sense of a kind of therapeutic psychology. And some of you are therapists. You know, therapeutic interventions or therapy, psychology in that sense, is very much in most modalities about stories. Right? It's about stories that that we tell and stories that we inhabit. The thing about stories that we live or inhabit is that sometimes they are way too deep for us to be able to put into words, way too deep for us to be able to tell. And the exercise 21, gives a good example of that, actually an example that goes very deep, where in the instructions for the exercise, Rinpoche writes, note that the sense of being distanced that allows for this investigation is itself the outcome of a narrative. So, in other words, we have a certain way of relating to our experience where we can describe it to ourselves or can notice it because we are distanced from it. Now, if that sense of being distanced was itself, as he says, the outcome of a story, the outcome of a narrative, that would be a great example of a lived story, something that goes so deep, so fundamental, that we don't usually have a way of questioning it. We have these two different kinds of exercises, one of which is looking at the structure of time, because the structure of time, as we usually see it, is inseparable from the story structure of our experience. And the other one is saying, just look at the story structure. You could look at time within that. You could look at time as a story that we tell or live.
May I ask you a question?
Yes, you may.
This distance, I start to write it down here, but this distance view or experience, is that something that we want to, quote, get away from eventually?
You know, that's a question that comes up in various ways in TSK. I think the first thing is to get clear on it. If we can experience the distance as distance, then it's going to change. Because part of what's going on at that deep level, the lived story at the level of how we create distance between ourselves and our experience, is that in order to operate the way that it does, it kind of has to operate in the dark. That's part of its whole way of being. And if we can bring light to it, then it will change. Whether we go away from it or not, you know, whether that change means that we now experience things differently, you know, we'll have to see. So the answer is, let's see. That's usually the answer in TSK is let's see. Give it a try. Let's see. I see you have a note here about a post, about a feeling of anxiety that comes up, if you drop your stories. And yeah, that may be true. And then you need to ask, in what sense is that another story? You just need to ask and see. Okay, I just want to make one more point. We've already gone pretty long, but I feel some responsibility to bring in chapter 22, which we haven't talked about at all. Chapter 22 talks about these two kinds of time, one of which is objective time, and the other one is the time that the self inhabits. And I guess that way of phrasing it is, it already includes the point that I want to make, which is that objective time, what I called before calendar time, even though it's very real for us, it's very meaningful. You know, the fact that we're going to meet again next Sunday is a part of my lived reality. The fact that I'm involved, engaged in calendar time or objective time helps define the kind of being that I am. Even though that's so, if we try to describe time to ourselves in that way, or if we think of time in that way, it's in the objective level, that's a story that we tell about time and about how time operates. It may be a presupposition of how we live the story of time, but it is not in itself live time. And a good way to see that is something that we all know about and I'm sure have thought about. It has to do with the fact that we were born and we're going to die. Those are objective facts. They're facts about the objective self. And we, of course, we know them to be true. But in terms of our lived story, they're only things that we know to be true. They're not our lived experience of time. The lived experience of time is very different. The lived experience of time is that we've always been here. And we're always going to be here. Until something completely unimaginable happens. And we do have that sense of something completely unimaginable is going to happen, which we may or may not notice. You know, I mean, some people are very involved with the question of dying. Other people just say, well, it's unimaginable, it's inconceivable, so I don't have any way of getting at it. But whatever the reaction is, the point is, at the time that we live in terms of our experience is not at all that object of time. So that's a good example. Chapter 22 and what it talks about is just a good example of the distinction between the stories that we live and the stories that we tell. Okay, I think that's it for today. The reading, I think what we're reading through right now and hopefully the exercises that you're working with have a way of engaging us. And if you do these practices, you know, exercise 22 I mentioned and exercise 23, and it feels like let's say you take 10 minutes to reflect on your experience in light of exercise 22, and during those 10 minutes you have no idea what you're looking for or what you're doing, that's okay. Maybe the having no idea is as close as you're going to get, at least for now, and that's okay too. Even to be aware of how connected, how bound up we are with a particular understanding of time is already a way of shedding light, of bringing light to a situation, a reality that usually operates in the dark. And that light is already a change. So that's, in and of itself, that's a good thing, whatever happens in the experience. Okay, So we'll talk next week, and I encourage you to keep doing posts on the website. There are lots of things you could be doing. So find ways to bring these questions, these practices into your life, because that's where it matters, that's where it counts, that's what it's all about. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you, Jack.
Many thanks, Jack.
Yeah.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.